They are one of the largest recipients of NIH funding. Their scientists played a substantial role in developing more than half the cancer drugs approved by the FDA in the last 5 years. Dana-Farber Cancer Institute has been making one advanced cancer discovery after another for over 75 years. At Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, what we do here changes lives everywhere. Find out more at danafarber.org/everywhere.
Corporate bosses are about to meet with the boss of China. From Marketplace, I'm David Brancaccio. Chinese President Xi Jinping arrives in Seattle today for the first part of a state visit to the U.S. Later in the week, President Xi will meet with President Obama at the White House. But first, he'll sit down with the CEOs of America's top companies. Marketplace's China Bureau Chief Rob Schmitz reports.
There's a reason the Chinese president is putting money before politics this week, says James McGregor, head of APCO in China and author of 1 Billion Customers.
This is a signal to the American political establishment that these may be American companies, but they know where their bread is buttered right now, and it's China.
Take Apple, for example. In 2009, the company made just 2% of its revenue from China. Today, 25%. That's why Apple's Tim Cook will be among a group of CEOs who will meet President Xi Jinping in Seattle. But there will be a lot of forced smiles around the table. Sean Ryan is author of The End of Cheap China.
It puts a lot of America CEOs in a difficult position because they're almost like supplicants. They're all flying to Seattle to meet with President Xi as if he's an emperor, and it's clear that he's going to dictate to them what opportunities exist for them in China.
Ryan says the business environment for U.S. tech companies in China is the worst he's seen in 20 years, and the Obama administration has done little to improve the situation. But that may change later this week when the presidents of the world's two largest economies meet face-to-face. In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
Let's do some numbers. The FT 100 stock index in London is down 2.3%. Stocks in European car makers are depressing things in Europe today. VW stock is down more than 18% now. VW just said it's setting aside the equivalent of $7.25 billion to pay for the burgeoning scandal over software installed in VW cars to cheat emissions tests. Dow and S&P futures are down about 1.5%, as if the Dow were down 248 points. There's a big vote on corporate governance today. Bank of America shareholders will vote on whether one man, Brian Moynihan, should have both the job of CEO and chairman. Marketplace's Scott Tong reports.
Several big shareholders are seething that Bank of America last year gave its CEO the chairman job without consulting them. Critics of combining these jobs say the CEO should run the company and the chair should oversee the CEO. To bank analyst Mike Mayo at CLSA, it's like a football team where one guy is the coach and the general manager. Sometimes you split them up.
If you've had a team that's lost a lot of games, then you say, okay, the coach focus on what's happening on the field and the general manager ensuring there's proper oversight.
Makes sense in theory, but studies are inconclusive. In the banking world, J.P. Morgan and Goldman combine the jobs and Citi splits them. Bill George at Harvard Business School was both CEO and chairman of Medtronic. He says separating these two jobs can bring power struggles.
A number of European companies have done this. The board of the pharmaceutical company Sanofi split it, and it led to a real rift in conflict.
Both he and Mayo say the question depends on the company and how it's doing. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
A CEO will go to jail, a 28-year-old sentence for Stuart Parnell. He used to run the Peanut Corporation of America, conspiracy to ship peanuts contaminated with salmonella. Hundreds were sickened. 9 died back in 2009. The company is now defunct. Parnell is 61, and his attorney says 28 years is a life sentence. Wealth and Poverty Desk has been focusing on gentrification, the people and economics that drive it. Today, we want to share one of the many interesting responses from our listeners, a Los Angeles real estate investor who's been questioning what she's doing to the neighborhoods where she works. Here's Marketplace's Chrissy Clark.
Call them confessions of an ambivalent landlord. Simone Shaw owns dozens of rental properties, many in gentrification hotspots. She says she loves making rundown properties beautiful again, investing in communities that have struggled from years of disinvestment. But she says things have changed in the last decade as she's partnered with more and more outside sources of money.
The major metric they were looking at was an Excel spreadsheet that had, you know, how much were we making on each of these investments.
She remembers a debate with some of her partners over whether they should increase the rent on one tenant by $50. Simone was against it.
They look at me like, that's you just being a softy again. And I get it. We're allowed to by law and we should do it. But sometimes you have a tenant who you know that $50, it's going to make a big difference to them.
Simone takes me to a property her company bought a while back, a hilly lot with a few bungalows on it in a rapidly changing neighborhood called Highland Park. She points at one of the units and says, the woman who lives in that one?
I don't think she likes me very much.
Simone explains that the tenant's family has lived in the place for two generations. Since the unit is rent controlled, that means they're paying way under market. When Simone and her investment partners bought the place, they wanted to rehab it and find new tenants who'd pay more. So Simone offered the tenant money to move out.
$40,000, and she said no. She said there was no amount of money that I could offer her.
These types of buyouts, they're perfectly legal, but Simone says they can feel weird.
It's particularly hard when someone's lived there and their families live close by and their kids go to the school that they went to school at. It's a really emotional thing. It's not, it's where these people live. So it's like, what, you want me to put a monetary value on that? What's wrong with you?
Which is why Simone tells me she is currently dissolving most of her real estate partnerships.
I got tired of having the type of conversations you get into when you're trying to sort of minimize your costs and maximize your returns.
She says she's planning to start over to see if it's possible to make real estate investments where the return she's maximizing is the health of the community, not just the health of the bottom line. I'm Chrissy Clark for Marketplace.
You can hear more about neighborhoods in flux in our podcast, York and Fig. Marketplace.org has a link. Our producers are Justin Ho, Katie Long, and Beatty Jong. From studios at Montclair State University today, I'm David Brancaccio with the Marketplace Morning Report from APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.